I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. While President Trump has called Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election a hoax, the intelligence community concluded even before the election that the Russian government had directed the hacking of emails and the use of fake online personas to interfere with the election process. Now, 2 years later, do we know whether that meddling influenced voters and the election results? Our guest, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, has concluded that Donald Trump's win was likely the result of Russian involvement. She was not an early believer and decided after looking at voter data, especially around the three presidential debates, that something was afoot. She took a deeper look at intelligence reports, indictments, the media coverage, WikiLeaks, phony ads, and more voting data, and concluded that Russian hackers and trolls played an influential role in the election outcome. Her new book is called Cyber War. And she's a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, and joins us once again on Radio Times. Nice to have you with us.
It's good to be back.
Likely. How are we supposed to take that word, likely?
If you think on one end of a continuum that it really didn't happen and we're absolutely certain it didn't, and on the other hand, ironclad proof it definitely did, likely says it's a lot closer to it happened than it didn't. It's more likely than not. But it also says that we don't have the kind of conclusive proof, in part because there are three separate ways that this could have happened. The first is the trolls. Those are the Russian imposters, right, who are pretending they're U.S. citizens, who are marauding around in cyberspace. They had the right theory of the election. They were targeting the right voters to mobilize, demobilize, and shift. They had access to the voter turnout models from the Democrats because the hackers had stolen them. And they had lots of information from our media environment about where they needed to go, who they needed to influence, because, frankly, our press spends a lot of time making us into consultants with all their tactical information and not as much as we'd like making us into informed voters. But what the trolls didn't do, as far as we can tell, or we don't know whether they did is a better way to phrase it, is reach the right people in the critical states. They reached a lot of people, but they had to reach them in the three decisive states in order to actually affect the Electoral College, because, as you remember, it's the Electoral College, not the popular vote, that decided the election. So that case is going to be tentative because we don't have the information, although the social media platforms do, to know if they reached the voters. The case for the hackers is stronger because the hackers changed the media agenda. They changed the dynamic of two debates because hacked content was used in two debates. And we look at polling data during the times at which the hacking content is featured in media and in those two debates and can make a plausible case the changes we see are attributable to the hackers. And then the final part of the case is if it was Russian information that influenced James Comey, and that last James Comey decision really dropped Hillary Clinton in the polls substantially, then the case becomes firmer.
I want to take all of that apart and put it all back together there. But you do say in the book, and I think when having a conversation like this, that Donald Trump is the president of the United States. So you are not saying that he is an illegitimate president.
And it's really important to make that point because I want to step very far back in this book and ask what is happening inside an electoral process and not make assumptions about what the outcome should or would have been. This is not a book about who should have been elected. This is a book that's trying to describe what the Russians did and what the plausible effects are, given what we understand about how media effects have worked in the past. But there's no evidence that the Russian hackers or the Russian trolls actually pulled any levers or changed any votes. And I take the National Security Agencies at their word when they say they haven't found that evidence. Right. They got access to registration data, so they could have tampered in some cases. But our intelligence services say that they didn't. And as a result, they did not elect. They helped, and the question is, did they help enough?
And there wasn't, and you're not saying that there was, and this is all about what the book is not about, but you're also saying it was that this book is not about any kind of collusion.
And that's a second really important point to keep in mind, because people make the assumption that the minute you mention Russians and you mention Donald Trump, you must be making that argument. And actually, I am making the argument that given the patterns that I see, particularly in the use of the trolls' social media content, it wasn't necessary for there to be coordination. There's a remarkable similarity between what the Trump campaign is doing and what the trolls are doing. There is a synergy that is created because the hackers through WikiLeaks drop information at times that benefit Trump. But in neither case was it necessary for the Russians to have help from the Trump campaign to know how to do that. Let me just take a minute to explain why, because it's really important.
Sure.
If you are sitting in St. Petersburg, how do you manage to get your messages aligned with the Trump campaign's needs? Well, first, you read the U.S. media, whose tactical
coverage— It's pretty obvious, isn't it?
—tell you how. Secondly, you go to the social media platforms whose targeting structures make it possible for amateurs, for you or for me, to reach those audiences. Remember, you've read in mainstream media who needs to be reached. So the targeting structures aren't like old-time buying where you really had to have a command of a sophisticated art. This is really simple. Press the right levers, click the right links, and you get to target those individuals. So the platforms were made to develop advertisers, to advertisers' products. to the public. And as a result, that could be exploited very easily. And then there's a third factor. They had the Democratic playbook, so they knew who Hillary Clinton needed to influence and who Hillary Clinton wanted to stay away from the polls. They just had to flip that playbook and know what to do. So that's actually a strong argument that coordination wasn't necessary to see the effects that I see.
And the playbook came from WikiLeaks essentially attacking or downloading information from the Democratic National Committee and also from the Trump campaign. Excuse me, the Clinton campaign.
Not WikiLeaks, but the Russian hackers. So one of the problems that the whole model of our democracy had with this hacking is the Russian hackers got the content, and then they put it through WikiLeaks, and the press treated it as if WikiLeaks was the source and ignored the fact that our intelligence community had concluded as of October 7th, 2016, that it was the Russians. And so if you think it's coming from WikiLeaks, you don't ask the question, why do the Russians want to help Hillary Clinton or disadvantage Donald Trump? You also don't ask the question, what is Julian Assange have an interest in this election, because you're thinking WikiLeaks, not Julian Assange, who runs WikiLeaks. Julian Assange doesn't like Hillary Clinton because Hillary Clinton wants him prosecuted for what she sees as a serious misuse of classified information in her life while she was as Secretary of State. And Putin doesn't like her either, because Putin thinks that Hillary Clinton was in part behind demonstrations against him when he was seeking election.
So do you think the goal was to cause chaos to in a sense, and perhaps they won, to get us at each other's throats? Or was it to prevent Hillary from becoming president, or conversely, to have Donald Trump win the election?
There's an argument that says that a lot of the content that we see is trying to sow social discord. And as a result, that must have been a prime objective, and a secondary objective would have been election or defeat. So, election of Donald Trump or defeat of Hillary Clinton. More so defeat of Hillary Clinton, by the way, than election of Donald Trump, because, Putin basically is being opportunistic. And you can see the point at which they clearly are starting to intervene on behalf of Trump and against Hillary Clinton. But when you step back and you look at what is happening in the environment, what you see is that you've got content that is coming to play at a time in which the electorate is particularly vulnerable. And the Russian hacked content is coming into an electoral environment in which those vulnerabilities mean they're able to create impact if you don't ask the question, who's behind this? And as a result, ask, why would someone want to elect or defeat? But you also, in the backdrop, see a lot of sowing of discord. But ask this question. If we have Barack Obama as president and the heir apparent is Hillary Clinton, and we sow chaos because we get groups to clash with each other in the cities, and that chaos is around issues that are consistent with Donald Trump's agenda, who's disadvantaged? So you don't have to mention Hillary Clinton or mention Donald Trump if you've got a Democratic president and his heir apparent is Hillary Clinton, and you create tension between Muslims, for example, and people who oppose Muslims, for example, between African Americans and the police, for example, between those who favor gay rights and those who oppose gay rights, for example. That kind of chaos raises cultural anxiety, and cultural anxiety in this last election predicts a greater likelihood of voting for Donald Trump.
You include, and actually I posted on our Facebook group, some of the information that was sent out to the American public. One is a picture of Hillary in red. She's got devil's ears, and she's fighting with Jesus, over the future of America. Does that work? Is that persuasive? And if it is, who is that persuading? Who is being targeted?
What I find really intriguing about the process that the Russian trolls, those are the persons who are marauding about in cyberspace, were doing was they first used benign appeals that identified the target audience. So when you see Jesus fighting with Satan and it says, like, if you want Jesus to win, I now have you identified with the Christian community. Now when you show Satan fighting Hillary Clinton, like, if you want, Jesus fighting with Hillary Clinton. Now, like, if you want, Jesus to win, what you've established is this is a person who identifies with Christianity.
Right.
Now, through the look-alike process in social media, I can say, okay, if these kinds of people like this, then I want to target, in general, these kinds of people when I move to the next level of content as I try to advertise with more targeted appeals.
And more sophisticated.
More sophisticated,
I mean, going up the chain.
And more extreme appeals. And so what you see across time with the troll content is they start out trying to find the audience, and then they move to the more extreme appeals. So they start out, for example, in trying to identify African Americans with things, appeals that say things like, aren't these beautiful black women? And then you say, yes, these are wonderful examples of people we're really proud of. Like, standard appeals to identity. And then once you're able to say, okay, now these are the kinds of people who are attracted. Now you use the lookalike to expand to get greater numbers. And then you start to see appeals not to vote.
In fact, you say that there was concerted targeting of churchgoers and military families. They seem to be the target audience.
There are three target audiences that are consistent with Donald Trump's electoral needs. The first are target audiences that Donald Trump needed to mobilize. And the trolls in cyberspace are making appeals to white evangelical Christians, white conservative Catholics. So basically, church-going Christians who are white. And then secondly, veterans and military households. If Donald Trump gets the level of the vote that he has in August, in November, from those two groups, he will lose the Electoral College. So they're mobilizing. They're trying to demobilize African Americans. They're trying to demobilize the black vote. And they're trying to demobilize Sanders supporters. And they're trying to shift any that they can't get for Trump over to Jill Stein, over to a third-party candidate. And so they're actually making a combination of five moves, but that you can divide into three parts. The first is mobilizing, the second is demobilizing, the third is shifting.
I do want to talk more, but we do need to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Kathleen Hall Jamieson is our guest, and she's got a new book. It's called Cyber War, subtitled How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President, and sub-subtitled What We Don't, Can't, and Do Know. First time we've had a sub-subtitle, I think, on Radio Times. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join the conversation and much, much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Kathleen Hall Jamieson. She's a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, also director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center and co-founder of FactCheck.org, and she's got a new book called Cyber War. Let me pick up on something. And you talked about how the hackers were and trolls were targeting military families to benefit President Trump. Not that there was coordination, but to benefit President Trump. How do we understand that message when candidate Trump, frankly, insulted John McCain early on in his campaign, saying, I don't like prisoners who weren't captured, which of course makes no sense. But how do you understand if the target is the military people? How does he get away with that, but not this?
Well, one of the reasons that Donald Trump is in trouble as a candidate in summer of 2016 is not only has he insulted the heroism of John McCain, but he's attacked a Gold Star family. And remember, this is a person who had multiple draft deferments for a transient bone spur. So he's not the natural candidate of military households. But military households prefer Republicans on average historically. So if this is a category of voter who's likely to vote, that category is going to vote Republican. So the danger for Donald Trump is that those Republicans who are in military households are going to say, I think I'm just going to stay home, which is why what his campaign and the Russian trolls are both doing is trying to mobilize them. And they're trying to mobilize not by saying positive things about Donald Trump, but by saying negative things about Hillary Clinton, by trying to make her the worse of the two candidates. You see the same thing with the Christians who are white evangelicals and who are conservative Catholics. Why would they, you know, feel that they're not going to turn out with any enthusiasm? That is, they're likely to stay home. If they're going to vote, they're going to vote Republican on average at very high levels. Well, he's thrice divorced. He said some pretty vulgar things on Howard Stern's show. And then after October 7th, you've got the Access Hollywood tape out there. So you've got now a constituency that is probably going to vote Republican if it votes. And again, the question is, can you mobilize? So are the appeals saying that Donald Trump is your candidate? Yes, here they are. Here they're pointing out his alliance with the ideological reasons that those constituencies support. So he is pro-life. They are pro-life. He will defend Christianity. He believes in saying Merry Christmas. He will defend saying Merry Christmas. He will protect political speech in churches. So they're making very strong appeals as a campaign, mm-hmm. and then the Russian trolls come in and reinforce those appeals. So those are mobilizing moves that are necessary because Donald Trump can't assume he's going to get the historical average vote that you'd expect from those two constituencies in the absence of a pretty strong case for him and against Hillary Clinton.
I do want to play a clip from the second presidential debate. This took place on October 9th. But let me just preface it by saying on October 7th, and frankly, Kathleen Hall Jamison and I had forgotten this, the intelligence community comes out saying that the Russian government is trying to influence the outcome of the election.
Through the hacking.
There's the Access Hollywood tape that gets revealed. And then shortly after that, WikiLeaks releasing more Podesta emails. So on that one day, you've got boom, boom, and boom.
And what you have is the first story gets lost. So the press loses track of the intelligence community's conclusions that the Russians were the hackers. The Access Hollywood tape, very negative story for Donald Trump, is counterbalanced by the release of the first tranche of Podesta emails, in particular speech segments from Hillary Clinton that Bernie Sanders had been seeking throughout the primaries. And so instead of a weekend news agenda as we come into that Sunday, October 9th debate 2 days later that has two negative Trump stories, the Russians were behind the hacking. Why would they want to help Donald Trump? And the Access Hollywood tape, has he just disqualified himself from the presidency? We have a counterbalancing in the press between the Access Hollywood tape and did Hillary Clinton really say she favored open trade and open borders? Did she say she had a private and a public position? Those segments from speeches are used to say we have problems with both candidates. They both have public-private issues. In his case, was that just locker room banter? Or is it what he actually does in private? Is it admission of sexual assault, or is it just the way men talk when they're in private? In Hillary Clinton's case, did those speech segments really suggest that in private she was different, said things that were different, gave assurances that she didn't say in public?
Let me play this is the question, and it comes from Martha Raddatz, and it's actually taking an audience question, putting it to Hillary Clinton.
This question involves WikiLeaks' release of purported excerpts of Secretary Clinton's paid speeches, which she has refused to release, and one line in particular in which you, Secretary Clinton, purportedly say you need both a public and private position on certain issues. So, two from Virginia asks, is it okay for politicians to be two-faced? Is it acceptable for a politician to have a private stance on issues?
Now, we can argue about these paid speeches, and there were, I think, a lot of things that Hillary Clinton did that really hurt her as a candidate. But this idea of being two-faced, of having a public and private persona, was that something that she had to deal with more than Donald Trump at the time?
Well, first, because Bernie Sanders throughout the primaries had asked to have the speeches released, and Hillary Clinton had not released them, Hillary Clinton created the possible inference that she was hiding something.
Right.
So when the speech segments are released, the press makes the assumption that they must be revealing something, because why else would she not have released them? She could have solved all this by simply releasing those speeches. Those speeches, by the way, don't contain confirmation that in private she was saying to the bankers, which was Bernie Sanders' concern, that she might not be as tough on them as she suggested in public. So, for example, might she in private have been saying, I'll get rid of Dodd-Frank? Well, it turns out, no, she didn't. That public versus private statement that she makes that is being quoted by Martha Raddatz is in the context of a segment of a speech in which she's talking about Steven Spielberg's film about Lincoln,
right,
in which Lincoln very dexterously maneuvers his way through the complexities of the Civil War by talking to one group and then another in somewhat different terms, trying to hold things together long enough to get the war to resolution. So what you think you are hearing when you hear only the statement, sometimes you need public and private, you think you're hearing a confession that the speeches contain what Bernie Sanders thought they might, a revelation she was actually saying different things. No, they don't. What that statement actually was about a speech that she gave in the context of talking about a Lincoln film. You lose that context in that debate. And it's then translated into, is it okay to be two-faced?
Yeah.
As if you read the speech segment, you'd see that she was two-faced. If you read it, you don't see that at all. So what you have is, had the Russians not hacked and WikiLeaks not released, and that statement not been taken out of context from the actual statement that WikiLeaks released, Hillary Clinton could not have been asked that question in that way with that level of credibility. The implication is, in the debate, she's lying about what she said in the speech, when in fact she's not.
And two-faced. I mean, you know, to me, I was thinking about that word, or those two words put together, two-faced. She's a hypocrite.
Yes. And it plays into an existing narrative because of the Bernie Sanders situation, and because across time, Hillary Clinton has been a very wary candidate. She's very cautious about what she says, and she has not completely accurately answered questions about the emails on the server, including in a very controversial interview with Chris Wallace, in which she says there was no classified information, when in fact there was.
Let me play a clip from the third debate. We are reliving the presidential election of 2016 with our guest, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, and again, this is the moderator, Chris Wallace, asking Hillary Clinton about parts of a speech she delivered to a Brazilian bank about a, quote, dream of open borders. Let's hear his question.
In a speech you gave to a Brazilian bank for which you were paid $225,000, we've learned from the WikiLeaks that you said this, and I want to quote, my dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders. So that's
Thank
the
you.
Question. That's the question. Please quiet everybody. Is that your dream, open borders?
So how does she answer that?
Well, first, let's go back and put it in context, because in the beginning of a sentence, she says that she supports open trade and open borders, and the rest of the sentence says sometime in the future, and then the sentence talks about energy transfer. So she is not saying open borders now. She's talking about the future, and the context is energy transfer. Donald Trump and the remainder of that exchange makes this out to be about immigration. It's important because Hillary Clinton has been saying she does not stand for open borders. Donald Trump has been saying she does. And this segment appears, as quoted by Wallace, to be an admission that in private she was saying something she wasn't saying in public. Well, if you'd read the rest of the sentence, but by then it's been obscured because news has not been contextualizing it across that entire two-week period when the content has been available, the public would know that there was more to it. And what is important is, for Donald Trump, open borders is a digestive statement. It synopsizes his whole attack. It stands for refugees coming in that he doesn't want here, immigrants coming in that he doesn't want here, trade coming in that he doesn't want here, and Hillary Clinton being irresponsible on all. Donald Trump actually puts out a tweet that suggests that the fact checkers who said before he was inaccurate about saying she stood for open borders are clearly now proven wrong, because she herself has now admitted it. So again, you have Russian hacked content released through WikiLeaks, and the press abbreviated to be consistent with a narrative when, in fact, the context of the sentence does not support the narrative. Hillary Clinton says, but that's Russian content, and that's not what I said. I said energy transfer, and Donald Trump basically says, you lie.
Well, do you think the press then was harder on Hillary Clinton, or they just did not understand how Donald Trump not just communicated, but in a sense manipulated the press. And I say that because I remember watching on television, whether CNN or MSNBC or some of the other cable stations, where Donald Trump was going to arrive in an airport somewhere, and that camera sat waiting for his arrival while the hosts talked about Donald Trump.
I think in these two cases, what you have is the rush of a huge amount of content being dropped on the press on a weekend. Remember, this originally is dropped into Press View on the 7th of October, right, when we have these total of three stories there, including Access Hollywood. And it's an enormous amount of content for them to wade through. And they very quickly moved on to air, I believe, based on a pre-existing narrative, and they weren't aware that it was fashioning the way in which they were excerpting the content. So they inadvertently, I believe, I don't think this was done maliciously, took things out of context because that seemed to be, to them, what was there, and they weren't looking carefully at it as a result. And in this context, because the press had not said it in the broader context, when Hillary Clinton tries to do it and you're watching the debate, you say, she's being disingenuous, she's ducking the question. Well, she's not. Now, it doesn't mean that the press doesn't take things out of context in other places, too. It does. But under those circumstances, you often are just focused on a single thing. Here, I've got an explanatory context. They were dealing with an awful lot of content. And one of the tactics that we have to worry about going forward is the hacking and release of large amounts of content, because the press didn't keep it tied to the Russian sources, didn't keep it tied to Julian Assange, didn't ask how does the intelligence community know that the Russians are the agents. After all, Obama's the president. You could reasonably say, well, aren't you just doing Obama's business? Let's find out what the reality is. You could say to the intelligence community, you got weapons of mass destruction wrong. How do you know he got this one right? We never had that debate. Secondly, they credited to WikiLeaks obscuring the source. But in the process, you did not hear them saying, and you did hear Martha Raddatz saying, purported.
Right.
You'd expect that before you use hacked, leaked content, you would say, we've not been able to independently confirm it. And in the process of saying that, a reporter would look more carefully at it and be less likely to take it out of context. And when Martha Raddatz says purported content, she is the exception, not the rule. Note Wallace doesn't say that. You also, in the process, had stories put into news context that now, looking back, weren't newsworthy. You say, where's the scandal in some of this? And the press didn't have clear rules about what was and was not newsworthy. There's an exchange between Jennifer Palmieri, a high-level Clinton aide, and a friend outside the campaign in which they seem dismissive of evangelical Christians and conservative Catholics. Now, this is not Hillary Clinton saying it, and there's no evidence that the campaign acted in that way. Should that, as a result, be newsworthy? The press needs to think these things through.
And that's Kathleen Hall Jamieson, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me read some comments here. An email from Fred. I would like to hear Ms. Jamieson's take on a similar, very successful meddling across Europe, which gave rise to governments more friendly to Russia. And I wonder whether what we saw, and perhaps are even seeing now in the United States, do you see similar targeting in Europe?
One of the things that is important for us to remember, because we obviously focus on our own country, is it didn't start here. It has been happening in other countries around the globe. And this is the new world order. I mean, presumably the United States is engaging in this as well.
Well, I was going to ask you about
as
that.
As are countries other than Russia. So, for example, in 2008, it was the Chinese who hacked both of the campaigns. They didn't release the content, but they hacked into both of the campaigns in 2008. One of the things that intrigues me about uses in other countries is that the regulatory structures in other countries give some governments different kinds of capacities. When hacked content was released in the French election, just about on the eve of the election, it's about 48 hours out, they have a regulatory structure where the regulatory structure stood up and basically said to the press, you know, if this is inaccurate, you can be held accountable. Well, we have a First Amendment.
Exactly.
And no one would say in the United States, we want a regulatory structure like France's. So as we look at what has happened elsewhere, We need to ask, how do we navigate this and also protect our cherished First Amendment freedoms?
And that's a tricky balancing act. Let me read some more comments. A Facebook comment from Watson. The Russians do no more meddling than any other political group in the United States. A Facebook comment from Ron. Russian memes work best on the older, less savvy, less social media savvy folks. Younger people would see this as corny nonsense regardless of party affiliation. Do you agree with that? I mean, some of this does look really low level, unsophisticated.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm in the wrong generation to have initially understood this at all. So as you watch people interact online, the quickness, the speed with which they like and share is extraordinary. What this means is that people are not pondering the content. And take a look at the pictures in the book. Some of these are highly evocative.
Yes.
And some just seem silly. You know, you look at some of these and you say, how could that possibly work? You look at others and you say, it's highly likely that if you believe the visuals are real and they are juxtaposed with other visuals, a powerful way of associating two visual contexts, and you accept the telegraphic messaging, that you are influenced as you share and like very quickly. Also, when you're inside a social media community, the speed with which bots, the automated accounts used across the web and used also by the trolls, will create the illusion that your community likes this. Hmm. And as a result, you feel an identification with it that is preconscious. You're not saying, oh, a lot of people like it, and so I'm a fool. I should like it too. I will follow the herd. There's a social signal there that is powerful. So to the extent that you grab it, it has visual impact, it's telegraphic, and it expresses sentiments you're already disposed to agree with, you are highly likely to share and to like. And that's not a function of age. That's a function of your predispositions. We're highly critical of content that we are disposed to disagree with. We are very accepting and uncritical of content that reinforces our ideology. They were targeting people whose ideology was likely to be reinforced by the content, not countered by it.
And that's that good old confirmation bias.
That's
right?
Our friend, the confirmation bias, and we're all subject to it. So there's a tendency to say, well, I'm not, everyone else is, until you look closely at your own patterns of liking and sharing.
Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Kathleen Hall Jamison is our guest. We're talking about her new book called Cyber War. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and if you are just joining us, Kathleen Hall Jamison is our guest. She's got a new book called Cyber War, How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President, subtitled What We Don't, Can't, and Do Know. And again, she's a communications professor at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, and co-founder of factcheck.org. You can join us 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play another clip. And this is, we are reliving some of these debates. This was the first GOP debate, August 6, 2015. Mm-hmm. So this was the Republicans all on the stage together. And former Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly asked this question.
Mr. Trump, one of the things people love about you is you speak your mind and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides, in particular when it comes to women. You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account is
only Rosie O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't. Your Twitter account.
Thank you.
For the record, it was well beyond Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
Your Twitter account has several disparaging comments about women's looks. You once told a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president? And how will you answer the charge from Hillary Clinton, who is likely to be the Democratic nominee, that you are part of the war on women?
Let me get several responses from you there. Again, there's a lot in that minute there. The reason I wanted to play it was I wanted to compare that to Hillary Clinton talking about deplorables. How, as someone who's an expert in communication and political communication, compare and contrast those two things.
One is said in public. The other is said in a setting in which she assumes it's not going to be made public. And so one of the things we're looking at in the Hillary Clinton trajectory across the campaign is, what did she do to feed the narrative that she says one thing in public, another thing in private? And the deplorables comment falls into that. If you say stronger together is your campaign theme, but in private you say a quarter of the electorate is deplorable, that is, half of Donald Trump's supporters would be a quarter of the electorate. Well, that seems inconsistent, and it seems you're saying one thing in public, another in private. If you say that you're coughing is allergies, but you know it's already diagnosed pneumonia, that sounds like you're saying one thing in public and another in private as well. So it wasn't just the Sanders speech, Sanders' desire to get those speech texts out there, that was playing into the narrative that she says one thing another in public, another thing in private. When, however, those excerpts suggesting that she had said those things in private are taken out of context and put into public in both of those debates, we see an increase in the likelihood that the public watching the debates compared to the non-viewers, in the presence of everything that takes into account the difference, will say she says one thing in private and another public, which means they believed it before, and now they believe it more, and more people believe it. And that change predicts a changed vote. Now, what's the difference between the two? There's actually a profound similarity between the two. In this election, coming into the final months, we have the highest percent of the electorate that didn't think well of either candidate that we have ever seen in the history of the presidency. Why is the electorate so subject to demobilizing and immobilizing appeals? Because people are having trouble deciding to vote at all.
Right.
And if they're going to vote, for whom to vote? And you're hearing from each candidate signals that are yielding a public perception among the possible supporters for the candidate that, I don't like that from that candidate. I don't like that from the other candidate. And in an environment in which you have a high percent of disaffected individuals about both, and a higher than usual percent of independents, and a higher percent as a result not anchored to political party, what you have is an openness to persuasion from one out of eight, almost, people in the electorate coming into the final weeks. That's when the troll and hacking impact is at its height. That's why I argue you're able to get a communication effect at the margins.
How, though? You're co-founder of factcheck.org. So in a war between trolls and hackers and misinformation versus fact-checking organizations, who's the winner, or how do you win? How can we have facts win the race?
Well, first, the social media platforms are now trying to increase the likelihood that when you are searching for something that they have already crowdsourced and given to the fact checkers, and the fact checkers have said is inaccurate, that you see the fact checking alongside the information that you've sought. So part of what they're trying to do is increase the likelihood you at least have access to the correction. Now, we still have confirmation bias that is at play, and it is still strong, but it has less capacity to operate if at least you have access to an alternative. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the platforms are now trying to find means to identify sources of messages. We identify the content of the message in part and its credibility by assessing its source. And when you're looking on Google's YouTube and you see something that you see Larry King, you see Ed Schultz, now deceased but on air on RT,
right,
in 2016, you may not know that the next segment that you see on RT is the Kremlin talking to you. RT is in our hotel rooms. RT is on our cable networks. Now, when you see RT content on YouTube, there will be a disclaimer on the bottom indicating that this is government funded by Russia. You'll also see, by the way, that PBS gets government support. I wish they could say government funded. I wish we had enough money to be able to say that. But what they're trying to do is to tie source to message so that you can assess credibility. Now, you might say, well, I love the Russians. I want to accept this information from them. But you might say, oh, I'm going to be a little more wary of it because that's a foreign government talking to us.
Mm. Let me read something that Michael Hayden said, and this is from an article in The New Yorker that Jane Mayer wrote about you you in your book, but I wanted to pull out something that he said to her. Michael Hayden, the former director of the CIA and the NSA, is agnostic when talking about the impact of the Russian attacks on the election results. He said, the most successful covert influence operation in history. He describes what happened in 2016, but he concludes that although Russian hackers may have, as he put it, put their thumb on the American electorate scale, there's simply no telling the impact. It is just unknown. It is unknowable. Essentially saying we do not know how persuaded voters were by what the hackers were doing.
Now, I'd love to ask, after he's looked at the evidence in the book, if he's at least open to the possibility that we know more than we could have known in the past because there's now more evidence. I mean, the reason I don't make a conclusive case is that there are things that are not able to be known that would let you make a conclusive case. But the basis for the argument is that we know, according to evidence from past elections, when you change the balance of the messages so there's more total messaging against one candidate, that's when you shift votes on the margins. We know the trolls did that in social media. We know the hackers did that in mainstream media and conservative media. And we know that the hacked content was used to do that in the debates. The effects that we've seen in past elections and changes in the balance of messaging are larger than the effect needed to affect 78,000 votes. And I have survey data reported in the book that suggests that the specific content that was being used that talked about public and private self in the second and third debate, open borders in the third, public and private in the second, was registered in our surveys in a way that suggests that votes were changed. And votes were changed in a climate in which only 78,000 votes had to shift shift the outcome. So that's the reason for saying it's a probable case, not a certain case. And I would suspect that if General Hayden looked at all the available evidence, he'd be more inclined to say that than to say it's unknowable. What's unknowable is with certainty that they affected the change. What's knowable, I think, is that they probably did.
Let me look at a headline. I have it in my hands here. October 31st, 2016. It's the New York Times. It says, investigating Donald Trump, FBI sees no clear link to Russia. This is not trolls. This is the New York Times. With that headline, it's a complicated story, but nonetheless, what do you think an impact like that had on the race?
I looked carefully at that article because the New York Times has agenda-setting power. That article didn't get a lot of national pickup, and it didn't have influence across the major broadcast and cable outlets. Nonetheless, what it suggested for those who read the New York Times is that there was no there on Trump and Russia, when in fact, if you look to a bottom paragraph in that story, what you find is they missed their lead, because in the bottom of the story, they actually confirmed that there was an active investigation about Trump campaign links to Russians. I think the New York Times did the public an injustice when, in its headline, it created an implication that the Russian narrative, as offered by Hillary Clinton, now confirmed by the Mueller investigation, was not substantial.
Let me ask you about Comey, because a number of people have said that it was really James Comey, with his announcement in October that he was reopening the investigation into the server involving Anthony Weiner, and on and on and on from there. How much do you think that had an impact on how voters felt about Hillary Clinton?
During the 9 of the last 11 days, the news media agenda shifts dramatically against Hillary Clinton because of the reopened investigation's public communication. Had it been happening, the public didn't know, you would not have seen that shift in the media agenda. During that period, Hillary Clinton, conservatively estimated, drops 2.5 points in the national polls. That's enough to shift not only the 3 decisive states that decide the battleground, but also to shift Florida. It would have securely given her the Electoral College had there not been that shift. So the question is, first, did the Comey announcement of that make the difference? And then, am I correct in the book that Russian disinformation may have played a role in his decision to make public, by virtue of telling Congress, knowing it would leak, that he had reopened that investigation? If, in fact, there was Russian disinformation there, then the strongest argument I have in the book is Russian disinformation may have created a good part of a 2.5-point shift that decided the election.
And you go back to that summer, the first announcement, and questions about Attorney General Lynch.
Yeah, the Director Comey explains that the reason for his making the public statement in July which is an odd statement because it looks as if he's about to charge her. Through the whole first part of that speech, he's establishing the independence of the investigation, and he's going on and on about there's been no outside involvement. It's an odd, odd statement. And then says extremely careless, and you think, okay, he's going to charge, and then doesn't charge. So very odd statement. He explains the fact of making that statement and not simply not making a referral, which is what you would have expected, a simple print pass through of a piece of paper, by saying that you had the Bill Clinton meeting on the tarmac, and there is information that he cannot disclose because it's classified that also affected his decision, that he thought, if about to be released or if released, could have called into question the Justice Department's independence and the FBI's independence. News accounts suggest that was Russian disinformation, suggesting that Loretta Lynch had assured the Clinton campaign that the investigation wouldn't go too far. There's no evidence it was actual confirmation that she had done that. That it's Russian disinformation seems relatively clear from news accounts. If he made that public statement in July because of the fear of Russian disinformation discrediting the FBI and Justice Department, why would he not also have feared that it would have been dropped had he not made public the reopened investigation? He believed Hillary Clinton was going to be elected. We know that from his public statements. She would have been an illegitimate president had that information been dropped and released, in my judgment. She could have been perceived to be, by some, to be an illegitimate president. I believe he was protecting legitimacy of what he presumed to be her presidency by making that public. And I also believe that because the hacked content was largely perceived by press and public as being accurate, none of it was discredited, that had that information been dropped by the Russians, it probably would have been believed by substantial numbers and, as a result, could have caused a constitutional crisis.
So you're saying it was really Russian hackers that began this process with Comey?
It was the credibility given to the Russian hacked content throughout the campaign by the press and the fact that it was, as far as we know, accurate that made credible, I believe, a Russian move should Comey not make that investigation public that could have been used to say that they didn't tell us, that we would have voted differently had they told us, and as a result, she was illegitimately elected.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me read some more comments. A Facebook comment from Paul: if the American voter can be swayed by nonsense, and he was referring to something that I posted with the Hillary and the horns fighting with Jesus, then we have bigger problems. A tweet: lately I've been thinking a lot about what Putin and Assange know from the RNC hack. Could this have something to do with compromat or blackmail? We do not know that. But it raises an interesting question. In many ways, we're dealing with the DNC hack and the information that was found by hacking the Democratic National Committee. If the RNC or even the Trump campaign had been hacked, would we have been in a different place?
If it had been hacked and released. We don't know.
Yeah.
We're
learning things now, right?
We're learning things now, and in the past things have been hacked and not released, and it's not simply that the fact that they were hacked and released. They were hacked and released in a tactical fashion. So the fact of the Podesta first block of emailed content, including the hacked speech segments, being leaked to blunt the effect of the Access Hollywood tape is a tactical move to affect a news narrative. And news narrative so powerful that we know from Bob Woodward's book that the Trump campaign was considering moving Pence to the top of the ticket and putting Condoleezza Rice on as the vice president. Mm-hmm. In the absence of that release of hacked content, what would have happened that weekend? Two anti-Trump stories? The Trump candidacy might not have survived. So we've got to worry about any hacking and any leaking. Some leaking of content is legitimate. The question is, when a foreign government does it in order to create an impact on an election, how should we treat it?
Well, much more to discuss. Kathleen Hall Jamison, thank you very much for joining us today.
To be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Her book is called Cyber War: How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President, subtitled What We Don't, Can't, and Do Know. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. In fact, we want you to join our Facebook group, and there's lots of interesting and extra content that we have there for you, and also ways of carrying on the conversation after the program. You can go to our regular Facebook page and check out the video there, or you can also just type Radio Times listeners into the search bar, and that will get you there. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.